Okay, so in this talk I've been asked to discuss about the possibility of observing the epoch of ionization through the 21 centimeter emission line, and I'm sorry, but I guess that you'll hear some of the things that Javi has already discussed in his talk. So I'll first give a brief introduction on the physics of the 21 centimeter line, followed by an overview of some of the literature that has been appeared recently. Then I will show you a simulation of ionization that our group has been doing and how these have been used to discuss and estimate the diagnostic associated with a 21 centimeter line. I'll then discuss additional information that we can obtain combining studies on the 21 line with studies on the CMB anisotropies, and finally I'll also briefly discuss the contamination of the 21 centimeter emission due to foregrounds, in particular exagalactic foregrounds. So as we already heard from Avi, the 21 centimeter line is associated with the spin flip transition of the hyperfine levels, ground level of neutral hydrogen. And for this reason, it has been suggested since the early 50s and by Field, and then later on by Piero and collaborators, that these could be used to probe the neutral hydrogen at high redshift. And this, as we already heard, is a unique signature, unique diagnostic that we can use, because being a line, it allows us to probe the redshift evolution of the neutral hydrogen. The problem is that the spin temperature regulates the population of the levels gets very easily coupled with the temperature of the CMB, and so we need some kind of mechanism to decouple these two temperatures in order to be able to observe the line. And a possibility is the spin exchange collisions between atoms of neutral hydrogen, which is efficient in regions of relatively high density, so in the intergalactic medium, for example, at redshift greater than 30 or so, or in forming structures. In alternative, we have another mechanism you can rely on, which is the scattering by Langevin alpha photons. And this, as we heard, is a mechanism that becomes efficient only once the first structures which emit radiation has formed. So if we define a scattering rate to Lyman alpha photons with this equation here, we find that there is a threshold of the scattering rate, so that that can be translated into a value for the Lyman alpha background, so that backgrounds above 10 to the minus 21 in the redshift range of interest are enough to decouple the two temperatures. So the next question one may wonder is whether it's possible to observe the line in absorption or in emission. To do this, we can define the differential brightness temperature due to a patch of neutral hydrogen with optical depth tau, with this expression here, so that if the CMB temperature is above the spin temperature, we observe the line in absorption, otherwise we observe it in emission. And I actually borrowed this picture from a paper by Avi and Zaldarriaga. You see that at redshift below 200, when the CMB temperature and the gas temperature decouples, what happens is that the gas temperature drops adiabatically below the CMB temperature, and as the spin temperature decouples from the CMB temperature due to collisions, there is this range of redshift in which you can observe the line in absorption. Then, once you move toward lower redshift and structure formation starts, depending on the efficiency of the heating due to these structures, you can observe the line in emission. And there have been several studies in the literature which demonstrate how heating by Lyman alpha, or mainly X-ray photons, and also short heating during structure formation, is enough to raise the spin temperature above the CMB temperature and observe the line in emission. So, sorry? Yeah, because here it just means that the spin temperature is coupled with the CMB temperature. As I was saying before, once the first structure form and you have Lyman alpha progression, they decouple, and if the heating is enough, you can observe it in emission. Okay, so there have been a few studies of absorption of 21 centimeter, and as we heard, Loeb and Zaldaliaga have estimated the expected absorption prior to structure formation, for which we can expect value of in the temperature fluctuation of the order of milli-K. And I won't go into any details, as we have already heard about this. And other possibilities that have been suggested to study the 21 centimeter line in emission is, for example, the absorption due to neutral intergalactic medium towards higher redshift radio sources. And this is an estimate from a paper by Carilli and collaborators showing a typical absorption spectra that we can expect from a radio source at threshold about 10. I think this is in this case. A somewhat, let's say, complementary study has been done by Furlanetto and Loeb with a similar approach, in which rather than studying the absorption of the intergalactic medium, they study instead the absorption by mini halos and protogalactic disks. While the main difficulty in observing signature of absorption prior to structure formation is associated with the fact that at this stage we don't have instruments, and not even planned, which should have the right sensitivity to observe these kind of features at the required frequencies, which are lower than 50 megahertz. Instead, the main problem with studying the absorption in spectra of high redshift sources, radio sources, is related to the existence of these high redshift radio sources. So we don't know at this stage whether they actually exist or not. And an analytical estimate, you can derive that the minimum flux that a background radio source should have in order to be able to observe absorption feature in its spectrum is of the order of 1 millijansky. Clearly, this depends on the sensitivity of the instrument and of the value of the optical depth of the neutral patch that you are going to observe. But just to give you an order of magnitude, is around 1 millijansky. And according to the theoretical estimate of Carilli and collaborators, they find that we might expect a population of radio sources at ratio 10 with a flux of the order 10 millijansky, which should be or could be enough to observe these kind of features. And an alternative, it has been recently suggested by Yoka and Mezaros, that radio afterglows of gamma ray bursts could be also used as background sources. But in this case, and here I borrow a plot from their paper, they show that both the forward and the reverse afterglow shock and the afterglow, they have a flux, an expected flux, which can in principle be observed by the next generation of interferometer, but which is order of magnitude below the flux required for observation of absorption features. So this is certainly a very challenging, observation, which could give us insights in the state of the neutral hydrogen at high redshift. Even more literature has appeared on the study of the emission of the 21 centimeter line, and this list here is far from being complete. It's just to give you a brief example of some of the groups that are working on this topic. For example, Shaver and collaborators suggested that associated with reionization, one should observe a drop in the brightness temperature, which is known as global signature or step of reionization. Then Tozzi and collaborators derived the brightness temperature and the associated fluctuations due to the cosmic web, that is due to the density distribution of gas. And what they find is that at a ratio of about 8.5, which corresponds to an observed frequency of roughly 150 megahertz, the fluctuations are of the order of 10 milli-K, so this is the order of magnitude that we expect. Then Iliev and collaborators, and more recently He et al, studied the emission, as Paul was saying a few moments ago, emission from mini-halos and also hydrogen clouds. And for example, the Iliev group find that again, at a ratio of 8.5, the expected signal is comparable to the one that we should expect from the cosmic web. Now, this kind of study do not take into account the fact, the effect of reionization on the expected signal, which is which has a double effect. Let's say, from one side, it introduces additional fluctuations due to variation in the ionization fraction, but from the other side, it drops the it should drop the signal, as clearly it ionizes neutral hydrogen, so there is less and less neutral hydrogen present in the IGN. There have been several groups working on this topic, and here I just plot what we found. And in fact, at the redshift 8.5, the signal is much lower than the one estimated from mean halos or just a neutral hydrogen without including reionization. And just just for curiosity, to show also the order of magnitude comparison with the order of magnitude from the signal that I was discussing before from Loeb and Zaldaliaga. Clearly, all these models are, as the word says, model dependent. But the interesting thing is that the intensity of the signal that should be we should look for is of the order of a few milli-K. So the next generation of instruments should be should have a sensitivity of this order of magnitude if we want to observe reionization or the high redshift intergalactic medium through 21 centimeter line. I just downloaded from the web the specifics of the LOFER interferometer, because it is already under construction in the Netherlands and in Germany. And this interferometer will work at frequencies above 110 megahertz. And the interesting numbers here are that at an observed frequency of 200 megahertz, the full array, which will be used to observe point sources, has an estimated sensitivity of 0.03 millijoules in an hour of observation, which should be enough to observe high redshift radio sources if they really have the characteristics which have been analytically derived, theoretically derived, for example, by Carilli and collaborator. In the virtual code, in the virtual core mode instead, which will be used to observe the brightness temperature fluctuation, the sensitivity is 0.25K in, again, 1 hour observation time. So we will need longer exposure time in order to observe the estimated fluctuation in the brightness temperature, but still it's a feasible measurement. So we should be optimistic in this sense. I think that we'll be able to observe this kind of signature. The main challenge and the main difficulty is associated with foreground contamination. The main contribution to the foreground comes from synchrotron, galactic synchrotron emission, which has been extensively studied in the literature, for example, by Shaver and collaborators. More recently, instead, several groups have focused their attention on the study of extragalactic contaminants, for example, contamination, free emission from the sources, the same sources that produce the ionizing radiation. And here is just an estimate from a paper by Ho and Mack, which shows that, depending clearly again on the model and some assumption, but anyway, the signal expected by the foreground, the contamination, is higher than the expected 21 centimeter value. And also in the case of radio galaxies, this is from a paper by Tim Matteo et al., the foreground contamination is above the expected primary signal. And we'll come back to this topic in a moment at the end of my talk. As Avi was saying in his talk, the most promising technique to clean mats of 21 centimeter line from foreground contamination is to compare mats which are closely spaced in frequency. The problem with this technique is that it relies on the spectral index distribution of the sources, which shouldn't be too broad. Otherwise, in this case, this kind of cleaning becomes more and more challenging and difficult. Okay, now I will switch to, I will describe and discuss some work that I've been doing with my collaborators, and in particular we'll discuss some simulation of ionization that we've been doing and the associated diagnostic with the 21 centimeter line. So to study the process of ionization, we have used a combination of and high-resolution body simulation to retrieve the distribution of the dark matter and the diffuse gas, combined with a semi-analytical model to study the evolution of galaxies and their properties. So the characteristics of this simulation, they resolved objects with total mass of roughly 10 to the 9 solar masses, and they have a dimension of 30 megaparsec moving. And we have run different simulation changing the emission properties of the sources. For example, we have adopted both a Salpeter and a Larsen initial mass function, so mildly top-heavy initial mass function. The spectrum of the stars is typical of metal-free stars, and we have adopted a varying value for the amount of radiation, emitted radiation, which is able to escape from the galaxy. And we have followed the propagation of the emitted ionizing photons into the given density field using the radiated transfer code CRASH, which has been developed by our group, and which is based on a Monte Carlo approach to the problem of the radiated transfer. Okay, so as I was saying, we have run different sets of simulation, in particular to study different properties of the sources and also the effect of the environment on reionization. And here you just see the evolution of the neutral hydrogen amount density in a case of a field region, so a region of the universe with mean, let's say, characteristics. And on your right, instead, is the same simulation, which is instead centered on a protocluster. So you clearly see that the evolution of the ionized regions is different in the two sets of simulation. And although it starts earlier in the protocluster region because more ionizing photons are produced, most of the mean region is ionized, there are still islands of neutral hydrogen in the protocluster because here there are more high density peaks which are more difficult to ionize and which recombine much faster. Among the various sets that we've been running, I'll just choose two that we'll use in the following for estimates of 21 centimeter emission line. So one is labeled L20, and it describes an early reionization history in which reionization takes place at a ratio of roughly 13.5, and an S5 case of late reionization with a reionization redshift of roughly 8. So given these simulations of reionization, we have the evolution in redshift of the distribution of neutral hydrogen. So from there, it's really straightforward to produce maps of brightness temperature. So basically, we assume that there is enough heating to heat up the spin temperature above the CMP temperature, and we have derived these maps from the reionization maps. And this is a case of the S5 run. And as Abby was saying, in this case, it's really straightforward to calculate the brightness temperature because it's directly proportional to abundance of neutral hydrogen, and it doesn't depend on the details of the spin temperature. It's interesting to look at the distribution of the brightness temperature, which clearly at high redshift peaks towards relatively high value because most of the medium is still neutral. Then as you go down in redshift, you see that there are two peaks, let's say, appearing, which corresponds to epoch in which the medium is roughly half ionized, but the bubbles of ionization are not completely overlapped yet. And then as you keep going down in redshift, the peaks move toward lower and lower values as the medium gets ionized. The interesting quantity is to derive is the expected intensity of the fluctuations in the brightness temperature, which in this case are due to fluctuations in the underlying density distribution and in the distribution of the ionized regions. So the power spectrum that we find has this shape for the S5 and the L20 simulation run. And these lines correspond to different redshifts of the emission, so different observed frequencies. So the behavior in the late and in the early reionization case are very similar. And the peak of the emission is roughly as expected of the order of 10 mK. And with a peak in the late case of at a frequency of roughly 115 megahertz, and in the early reionization at 90 megahertz. Clearly, you see a decrease, as I was saying before, of the fluctuations going to lower and lower redshift as reionization proceeds. And here in the lower panel, there is just a contribution due to the neutral hydrogen, so without any any ionization. Now, Marco Valdes, during his undergraduate studies in Leiden, tried to play a bit with these maps of 21 centimeter emission line that we've produced to see what LOFAR would observe. So what he did has been to to take these theoretical maps, to convolve them with characteristic of the instruments. And just to give you a qualitative view, you can see that, especially for the case of the late reionization, so at higher frequencies, regions of low emission are clearly seen in comparison with regions of bright emissions, of strong emission. So it seems plausible that LOFAR will be able to observe these signatures, especially at the highest frequencies, while at the lowest frequencies, as expected, well, its sensitivity is pretty low, the detection will probably be much more difficult. I will just briefly introduce this, talk about the information that we can extract by combining these 21 centimeter maps with maps of CMB anisotropies. Again, from the simulation of reionization that I described you, it's very straightforward to derive the expected secondary anisotropies in the CMB by integrating along each time or in each line of sight the convolution between the ionized and the velocity field. And what you find is what you expect. No? Okay. Secondary anisotropies on scales larger than 3000 or so, with a power spectrum of roughly 1 micro K, which should be observed by the planned telescope like ALMA or ACT. Now, the interesting thing is that while CMB anisotropies are produced by free electrons, 21 centimeter line is emitted by neutral hydrogen. So we expect some kind of anticorrelation between the CMB anisotropies and the 21 centimeter line on scales of the order of the angle subtended by typical H2 regions at the redshift of the 21 centimeter line emission. And so we have taken our maps of 21 centimeter line emission and of secondary anisotropies in the CMB, and we have cross-correlated them. And here I just show the zero point of the cross-correlation function as a function of redshift for the two runs. So this zero point gives us an estimate of the typical dimension of the H2 regions, which is labeled here in megaparsec H to the minus 1. So, as expected, an early reionization case produces higher values for the zero point because we have larger ionized regions compared to the to a late reionization case. But what is interesting here is that if it will be possible to do this kind of observation, both of the anisotropies and the 21 centimeter line emission, from the cross-correlation of this information, we can extract information on the evolution of the ionized regions, and thus this can give us a more deep insight into the history of reionization and of the sources that produces it. And I don't think I'll have time to go into the details of the foreground contamination, so I'll just briefly mention a few things. We have studied the extralattice foreground contamination both from point sources and extended sources, and we have derived the free emission both from interstellar and intergalactic H2 regions directly from the simulation of reionization I showed you before. We have calculated the contribution from low redshift radio galaxies using the same simulation of galaxy formation again used before, and we have instead calculated the contribution from a synchrotron emission from cluster, both radio halos and radio relics, using simulation by Francesco Miniati, in which also cosmic rays and magnetic field are included. So our estimate of the contribution of extragalactic foregrounds is done in a completely self-consistent way with the calculation, with the estimation of the primary signal. And I'll just skip through the quickly through the transparencies. So basically, these are the relevant equations to calculate the contribution of the fluctuation from extragalactic foregrounds. So what you need is just to derive the mean emissivity for each type of source and the two-point correlation functions. So this is what we have done. We have done then this integration. And what we find is this. This is the primary signal. And this is the contribution from the extragalactic foregrounds that we have considered. So as expected, they are all order of magnitudes above the main signal. The positive thing is that some of these sources can be removed because they're bright enough to be observed by the telescopes. And so after removal, the contribution from the, for example, we just did it for the radio galaxies and the radio halos, drops. And there are some areas which could be free from extragalactic foreground contamination. And this is just an extension of the study that we've been doing as a function of different observed frequency and angle. So again, after a foreground bright source removal, there are some areas of the primary signal, which is this shaded area, which can be observed free of contamination. Okay, so I'll just come to my conclusions. I have described the simulation of reionization that we've been doing and how it is possible, it will be possible to observe the evolution of the neutral intergalactic medium through the emission of 21 centimeter line. And this kind of signal will be most probably observed by the next generation of interferometers like Blofar, Scow, PAST, or the others. More detailed information will be probably acquired if we'll be able to cross-correlate maps of 21 centimeter line emission with maps of secondary anisotropies in the CMB. And this kind of analysis should help us in discriminating different reionization histories and source of reionization. And after doing a self-consistent analysis of contribution from extragalactic foregrounds to the 21 centimeter line, we have found that after removal of bright sources, there might be some angles, especially large angles, about 1 arc minute, which could be free from extragalactic foreground contamination. And so I think we should be positive, and in the near future, we might be able, really for the first time, to observe, to have information on the redshift evolution of the neutral hydrogen at higher redshift. That's it.
If the ionizing background was uniform, one could easily understand why the densest regions would be the last to be ionized. But of course, that's not true. The densest regions produce more of the ionizing photons than less dense regions.
Yeah.
And so from that standpoint, your result is kind of surprising. And I was just wondering, given the difficulty of computing inhomogeneous reionization correctly, whether you think that is a robust result.
Well, for sure, it really depends on. I mean, I think it's a robust result in the sense that it's true that there are more ionizing photons produced, but for example, in these very high density regions, also the recombination rate is quite high. It's also true that there are, as you well know, a lot of difficulties in modeling really accurately the reionization. And clearly, this kind of simulation, the coupling, there is no coupling between the radiative transfer and the hydro or the galaxy formation. So also to have a more insight, deeply insight into these, one should couple the two things to properly account for the feedback effect of reionization on galaxy formation, structure formation in these high density regions.
I just wondered how much uncertainty there was in the amount of X-ray heating and what uncertainty that would lead to in kind of the redshift where you'd start to see the 21 centimeter intermission.
As also Avi was showing, you don't need much energy to heat up. And there are several sources of X-ray radiation. We don't know, for example, whether there are high redshift quasars, so that's a pretty uncertain source, but you can produce X-rays in supernova remnants, for example, and if the first stars are really massive and you have a supernova explosion, so you have this kind of source, or also during structure formation you have some kind of X-ray production heating. And from these theoretical estimates, it seems that it's very efficient. So if you have sources as you have, it should be pretty robust.
X-rays are ideal because of course they warm up the medium about the CMB, so you can see it in emission, but
it does ionize it.
It stays 95% neutral, but warm. So for advanced,
it's perfect.
Whether they are there or not.
Yeah, but for example, from structure formation, you have some.
There is
so there is for sure some amount. What I think that the most uncertainties are related with the X-rays from black holes or mini quasars.
But then again, if they can warm the gas above the CMB by a factor of a few, then the signal becomes independent of the spin temperature. So then the exact temperature doesn't matter
anymore.
Whether it's 1,000 Kelvin or 3,000 Kelvin, that would be the most relevant to provide the different factors in the center. I had one question. Low far and all these type of instruments, of course, have a sensitivity that decreases along the way. So it's not, for those instruments, it's much easier to simply be on the direction 6. Direction 15.
Yeah.
At a certain point, if realization is 20 or so, then you have to start to figure it for
fact,
years.
Yeah.
When what's the range, because you've done this calculation for low far,
how
far can we go in redshift before we run out of signal?
Well, we could hope, for example, on past. Because the main problem with, for example, low far and probably also SCA is that the range between 90 and 110 megahertz is swamped by radio signal from radios and TVs. So, and that could be the most interesting range of frequencies to observe, while past is in this valley in the middle of China where there is no contamination. And so the sensitivity is, I think it's a bit lower than the maximum sensitivity of low far and SCA, but for sure in that range is much higher. So we might hope to observe those redshift ranges with past.
Have you worried about the effect of dust? We were hearing this morning that dust could be a byproduct of quasar formation. And I mean, if there's dust under the IGN, that's going to kill Lyma Alpha, which you need to couple the spin temperature to the kinetic temperature.
Dust is not included in this calculation, but I don't think that they could have an effect, but only on much smaller scales.
These
not
are.
Not.
You want continuum radiation, which is not, which is only Lyman alpha photons are not emitted, the Lyman alpha photons from the galaxies, because otherwise they would propagate a little bit away from the galaxy and redshift away from resonance. So these are continuum photons that redshift into Lyman alpha, and then dust is not relevant.
Yeah.
Because they are not Lyman alpha photons at the source. I mean, so if dust is not intergalactic, you don't have to worry about it.
And the other point is that...
like attenuation, but it's not resonant.
And the other point, I guess, is also that dust is very concentrated. So...
continuum Lyman alpha to keep the any other questions? Okay, then it's coffee time. We'll have a meeting at 4 o'clock. Thank you. Well, let's thank all the speakers.